Since the four Moti kids were kidnapped and then subsequently safely returned home, too much to, I think, the country's relief, we've been learning a lot more about the kidnapping industry in South Africa. And I think it's right to call it an industry. It's an below the radar industry. But it turns out that kidnapping is far more common. Kidnapping for money is far more common. I saw the story today on News 24 that a 50 million rand ransom is allegedly being paid. The family denies it. And of course you're going to deny it, if whether it was true or not, simply because you don't want to create the impression that kids are fair game. You don't want to create the impression that you will pay next time, because that just raises the risk. Of course it does. And certainly the risk of kidnapping is something we need to be very well aware of in South Africa. Dr. Gerard Labaskagni is a forensic and investigative psychologist at WITS. And Gerard, are you astounded by the sort of apparent levels of kidnapping that exist in our country? Lots of stories coming out of the woodwork.
Yeah, I think also one has to be careful because, you know, when we look at the crime stats, it'll speak of kidnapping, but that's kind of any kind of situation where the legal definition is complied with, which means the unlawful restriction of someone's freedom of movement. So I can literally lock you in your office and I've kidnapped you. So it's not always going to be a kidnap for ransom. But we have definitely been seeing it, and you're quite right to call it an industry, since about, I think, 2016, 2015, when Omar Karim was kidnapped in Pretoria. And that was probably the first of these really big, high-profile, high-value sort of kidnappings that have been taking place. And it's an organized crime industry that's basically probably moved over from Mozambique, where they were doing this for many years, and felt that South Africa was ripe.
And what are the conditions that make a country ripe for this sort of activity?
I don't know whether the kidnappers feel that their technological skills and abilities far exceed the police's. These guys are incredibly highly technologically advanced, and for law enforcement to keep up with that, it's very difficult. And they are just using methods that you cannot trace, despite what any of your cousins, your uncles, friends promise you. And this is what usually happens with these cases. You get phone calls from everybody saying we can do X, Y, and Z to catch these guys. They're just very technologically advanced. And I think maybe they just also feel that South Africa's law enforcement capabilities are not at what it should be, or either they've, you know, prepped the ground by bribing the right amount of people and feel that they can operate with impunity.
And the sort of amounts that have been bandied about as the ransoms that people are prepared to pay. I mean, any parent will pay whatever they could, you know, any money they could get together for the safe return of their kids. That's not the point. But the fact is that it seems certainly on the surface to be a very lucrative industry.
Look, I mean, these guys don't randomly grab someone. They've done their homework for months as to who has enough money to pay what they want, and they target those people. And it will typically be a family-owned type of business. I mean, if you kidnap the CEO of Absa, Absa's not going to pay you. But if you kidnap the head of a big family-owned business or a family member, you know, it's viewed that these people have the money, they can materialize the money, whether it's in South Africa or overseas. So they do their homework beforehand. They don't spend all that time and effort grabbing someone who can't afford to pay. And it is about money, and I think we must be careful, as you said, discussing amounts and whether or not somebody paid, because it's a private financial matter if they did or didn't. And also you open that family up to further targeting if people think, well, there's people that pay. And anything from the low-hanging fruit criminals to the sophisticated ones then can see that family as a future cash cow.
And here is the danger, I suspect. And you, I mean, human psychology, you're the expert on this. If there is a mechanism for me to earn some money, and I may never have kidnapped anybody before, but I kind of see that it's working for some people, I may very well be tempted to try my hand at it. I may be clumsy. I may be ham-handed. I may actually cause harm to the person that I'm kidnapping through no desire to do so. All I wanted to do was make a bit of money. And it's when the amateurs start thinking that this is open season that the risk rises, I would think, exponentially.
Absolutely. And I get very nervous when we consult on a case and it looks like amateurs are involved, because precisely that reason, you know, might they get spooked off by the media attention? Might they just think this is going on for too long? They don't have the appetite. And that, of course, can mean that they cut their losses, and literally cut their losses by killing the hostage and disappearing instead of releasing that person. Whereas your professional gangs, like I said, this is a business transaction for them. They're in for the long game. 3 weeks in terms of the Moti children was incredibly short. You know, the typical this time period is 4 to 5 months. We've had people gone for a year. Because of the values involved and the professionalism of these people, they are in for the long game. whereas your low-hanging opportunistic criminals, like I said, and you pointed out, are the ones that I get very nervous about because they don't know what they're doing. Potentially the risk, the chance of catching them from the police activity is a little bit better, but I would definitely rather be kidnapped by professionals than a bunch of chancers who don't know what they're doing.
And then when it comes to debriefing the people who have been kidnapped, typically, are there common themes that come through?
Yes, I mean, obviously nobody's worked on all of these, so it's difficult to say. People's experiences might differ. But, you know, they're typically well looked after within, you know, certain constraints. They are fed. There's no point in you damaging the person who's going to be the leverage to get you money. So you have to look after them. You have to reasonably look after their medical health issues, feed them reasonably. There's no point in you beating them up. It doesn't really help. You know, the families want this person back, whether or not you slap them around a couple of times or not. So the kind of themes are, you know, they've been on the way to work or back, they're kidnapped, they're taken to a place, and typically it's a house that's been rented for a couple of months, and they're kept in a room that either doesn't have access to windows outside or some kind of interim passage in the middle of the house, you know, but reasonably well looked after. But of course, this will always be a traumatic event, no matter how well you looked after.
Absolutely. And I mean, and the sense of it is that we're on a rising trend rather than a diminishing trend. In terms of the capacity of the law enforcement officers who are tasked with tracking people down and possibly negotiating releases, how capable are we in that process? Is this something that routinely then gets outsourced to experts like yourself?
Look, well, there's two things. You have to separate the investigation from the negotiation. If you look at all these cases, the big high-profile cases of where it's probably the professional syndicates, nobody's been arrested. Nobody's been released by the police kicking down the front door. So I think that tells us that the police don't have the capabilities or might never have them, because I know in cases I've been involved in where the FBI was assisting the police, you know, other foreign law enforcement agencies, and the people were never arrested afterwards, or, as I said, the victims weren't released by police kicking down the door. On the negotiation side is basically the way you're going to get this person back, by interacting with the suspect. And the police have a very good hostage negotiation training program. I went through it when I was in SAPS, and they have negotiators that have worked on these big, high-profile, complex cases. I don't know whether they've got a proper consolidated strategy for dealing specifically with these cases from a negotiator point of view. And there are, of course, people like myself who left the police, some of the other people who are doing this privately, who are very good and very professional. There's a company, TSU in Cape Town, that has an ex-police negotiator, and they have a capacity. You just have to be careful that you don't get the chancer who's going to promise you they can do this, but they've never done it, or the investigator who tries to double hat being the investigator and the negotiator. That's a terrible combination. You just need to make sure you get the right people.
Dr. Gerard Labuschagne, thank you very much indeed. Forensic and investigative psychologist at Wits University. Astonishing. I mean, suddenly our eyes have been opened. I mean, everybody knows about the dreadful Lindbergh case. 1920, no, it's after he became famous, because he flew across the Atlantic in 1927. And then the Lindbergh baby was snatched soon after that and found buried in a shallow grave a mile away from the Lindbergh house. Family never recovered. I mean, and it's one of those legendary stories, of course. And you think this is the stuff of Hollywood movies. This is the stuff of Hollywood fact. In fact, it's the fact of South African life, increasingly, it would seem.